You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Raiderly Phoenix. Raiderly, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you.
So the way the show starts is with the big question: who are you? You know, what do we need to know about you, your qualities, your experiences, in order to start this conversation?
Well, I think of myself as a collective of all of the people I've ever been. So I've been a little girl who liked Barbie dolls and who wanted to be a math professor. That little girl still lives in me. I've been a teenager who felt pretty abused and pretty lonely and who didn't like the world at all and who had a lot of angst. And I've been a raw foodist who wanted to convert the world to raw food and wanted to start a raw food community. And more recently, I think of myself as a consciousness alchemist who's taking all the parts of myself and integrating them and also helping others get more in touch with all the parts of themselves.
Wow. That is a very, very concise statement that is very emotionally compelling and very mature.
Thank you.
In terms of just trying to hold on to what's of value and to try to let this other stuff kind of go away and pull it together. And each time you pull it together, it comes together, I'm sure, in a different way.
Yes. Yeah.
And how long have you been in Ithaca?
I've been here since August 2015. And the story of how I came to be here is kind of interesting if you want
to
hear it.
Sure, sure.
Well, my husband, Lathanian, and I were on a road trip, which started back in May of 2015. We started with a five-week permaculture internship at Heathcote Intentional Community in Maryland. And then we went on to dog sit for friends in Vermont for 3 weeks. And then that led to visiting some other friends we had in Vermont, which led to visiting some other friends in Vermont and some friends in Maine who were starting their own sort of homesteading thing there. And we're on our way back to Buffalo, which is where we lived at the time. And we thought, oh, we could visit White Hawk Eco Village, where we have some friends we've never visited at their place. We had met them through a gathering, and we had never actually been to their house. And we said, hey, can we visit you guys? Well, you know, it's on the way back. Well, this idea expanded. Lathanian, my husband, wanted to work more on our apartment in Buffalo, which is a total disaster, and couldn't do so because of my fume sensitivities. So if he cuts like chemically treated wood, I would become incredibly sick if it's anywhere near me.
Right.
And so this might be a strange time to start this, to say this already, but
sure.
Lathanian and I decided back in 2012 that we were polyamorous, and that's going to be important context for what I'm about to say,
sure.
Which is that while we were staying with our friends at White Hawk Eco Village, I decided to bust out this game I made, A Voice of Conscience, and their next door neighbor came over, and it turns out that he had a guest room. And he was saying, hey, you know, you're sleeping on a futon, and I know that's, like, probably not super comfortable. And I'm like, yeah, there's, like, you know, kids awake at all hours of the night. And so I come and I stay in his guest room. And this is while, and my husband goes off to Buffalo to work on the apartment. And over the course of 3 weeks, I'm spending, you know, 4 to 7 hours talking with this guy every day. And I completely fell in love with him. He was amazing. And so I called up my husband on the phone when, you know, we've never been apart that long in the 6 years we'd been together at that point. And I'm talking to him every night and I'm just like, I don't know what's happening. I think I'm falling for this guy and it's just not expected. And he's not what I imagined. And he's, you know, my husband just gives me the thumbs up. He's like, go for it. I'm glad you're so happy, you know, like I'll see you, you know, in a week or so. And the funny part is I've been there ever since. Like, literally, we were on the way home, and then I just never basically went home. I mean, I visited, of course, many times. But Greg and I have had our commitment ceremony May 1st. That's tomorrow. So our one-year anniversary is tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And Lathanian, my other husband, lives with me. So.
Wow. I mean, that will be something to explore as we go forward here. People's lives are many and varied. You brought some music, so let's cut to music, and then we'll come back to polyamory. But we'll also probably touch on a whole bunch of other things because your life is many things. So, what should we start with?
Go ahead with Drive. That sounds great.
Okay, here we go.
Mm-hmm. myself how much I let the fear take the wheel and steer.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Raiderly Phoenix, and that was Incubus and Drive. So Raiderly, why did you pick that song?
Well, I heard that song for the first time on the radio when I was 10, I want to say, and I just resonated so powerfully with it. The idea that I would choose my own integrity over being one of the hive, as they say in the song, just struck me powerfully. I'm like, I'm going to be the person who chooses water over wine, and I'm going to be the person who holds my own and drives my own life.
Mm-hmm. So, and you heard that when you were 10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Once upon a time, I fell in love with a fifth grade feminist when I was in fifth grade. And she was the girl in the class who had the capacity to challenge people. And she came from a poor family, and her sister had died of a treatable disease, a form of bacterial meningitis. And so she was angry, but she was also driven by good stuff, you know, but that there was a wonderful mix in her about choosing. And she chose a life that has really satisfied her in many, many different ways. And how did you come to that? What was the experience that gave you that strength or that insight, or do you know?
I actually, at the age of 10, I think it was mostly that I was growing up in a very ghetto environment with parents that were old enough to be my own grandparents. And so they were raising me with very traditional values. They both had a college education. So they were, you know, raising me to use a wider vocabulary than was typical of my neighborhood and a very different perspective than was typical of my neighborhood. So I felt very much an outcast, but I also had a lot more resources, internal resources, than the other children around me. I understood a lot more of what was going on. Just because of having like inquisitive parents who asked me tough questions a lot. I had benefited from a homeschooling that they didn't benefit from on the other side of school. And it made me feel like I had a cause to need to lead people and to help people that were around me.
Right. And I'm gonna play with that for a second, and forgive me. But when you are formed as a person with that kind of intentionality, and a lot of kids grow up kind of on their own, even if they have, especially if they don't have people who are introducing them or saying, here's this, go look and see what you find and come back and tell us, where you have that kind of a relational experience of discovering the world around you. And some kids are just thrown out there and they never really get a chance to reflect. Mm-hmm. So they don't become articulate, or they don't become a self in the way that you became a self.
Absolutely. I think a lot of it also has to do with my writing at such a young age. Like, I started wanting to write when I was like 6 and starting to journal. Mm-hmm. And the more I journaled and wrote, the more consciously I was creating myself, because I was putting the thought on paper, reflecting on the thought, thinking about the event that happened, reflecting on how I felt and putting that on paper, and having that ability to reread it, to see it in front of me, gave me a choice to say, I like this or I don't like this about myself.
Right. And I may not be able to tear up the past, but I can make the future different.
Exactly.
And that is an incredible, incredible skill. So bring us up to speed in terms of up to now. What other things have happened to kind of help you become the person and live the life that you value now? And you've lived several lives along the way from your opening comments.
Yes, yes. You've heard a little bit about how I came to be, you've heard a little bit about me being polyamorous. Another big part of my story is my food journey, which started out as just really poor health. I had mononucleosis 4 times. I had chicken pox 2. Both of these are incredibly unusual. They're indicative of an incredibly compromised immune system. And at the age of 16, I developed what I called the burping disease, because I had no idea what it was, but I constantly was burping all the time. And I'd never really burped much before that. And I started becoming basically debilitated by pain. And I was in my senior year of high school. And what I did prior to school and after school, most of my senior year, was curl up in a ball in pain. And I was doing half day of school and then working for like 4 hours after school as a web design intern, because I thought maybe I wanted to be a web designer. And the work life, like, I liked what I was learning, but it was so hard because of how much pain I was in. And school was just miserable. I was like, I can't wait to get out of high school. This is all so much nonsense. And
you could go half time. I mean, you had the coursework behind you or whatever.
Yeah, I took a lot of extra classes my first 3 years. And I was very ambitious about moving forward faster. And then I was just completely halted in my tracks by poor health. And my doctors, you know, I told them I was experiencing chest pain, and they thought, oh, well, you have anxiety. So they tried to put me on antidepressants. And the antidepressants didn't do anything. They just made me feel worse. And so I refused to take them after a very short period of time. And I was like, well, the doctors aren't helping me and I'm in debilitating pain. What do I do? So I hit the internet. And I hated researching. I hated it. Like, up to that point, I was not a researcher, but I had to become one. I discovered Dr. Mark Hyman. His blog had an elimination diet. And I tried that. And within a week of his elimination diet, the mysterious burping was gone. And I eventually discovered that what I had was chronic acid reflux. I had GERD. I eventually figured out that I had stomach ulcers. I had developed a hiatal hernia. I didn't learn any of these terms until I was over the age of 20. So it was more than 3 years later before I actually understood.
Wow. And they didn't, I mean, from just what you said, I would have begun to guess those things anyway, just as in my own lay terms. But they didn't, the medical people didn't think there. They just described it. Assigned it to anxiety.
Well, it was more than 13 years ago we're talking now, and I think that the medical industry didn't quite yet believe that a 16-year-old girl could have stomach ulcers. It just seemed too rare, too far-fetched. Now it's becoming increasingly common, but I was like one of the forerunners.
I've known children who've had stomach ulcers. I mean, because of a lot having to do with stress.
Yeah.
Intense stress. Rural ghetto stress.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't believe someone who was so articulate, sure, didn't understand what acid reflux was.
Right. Well. Anyway, I interrupted you, and I'm sorry. But
no, it's okay.
So how did you, as you were doing this research, how did you discover what led to your healing?
Well, the elimination diet was just kind of a start. I thought I'd do it for a week, and then I did it for 30 days. And in those 30 days, I lost 30 pounds. I was essentially playing World of Warcraft at the time, so I was doing no exercise, but I lost 30 pounds in 30 days. So this kind of was like, wait a second, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Why did I lose weight? And I just started getting really addicted to researching. And I tried going to a raw vegan potluck when I was 18 for the first time. And I only went because I was like, well, it sounds like it should be food I could eat. But honestly, I didn't know what a vegan was, and I didn't know what raw food was. So I had no idea. Mm-hmm. But I get there, and they introduce all the foods, and they list off the ingredient of each food that's served. And this was really good because I'd already gotten in the habit of reading all the ingredients. I was avoiding hydrogenated oils. I was avoiding any kind of refined sweeteners, which includes, you know, sugar, molasses, on and on. And I was avoiding any kind of, I was trying to avoid animal products, but I didn't think of them as animal products. So I didn't think of myself as a vegan. So for example, I didn't know butter was a dairy product. That's how much of a city girl I was.
Right.
I didn't know butter came from cows. And so I go to this raw vegan potluck, and they introduce things like apple pie, but then the apple pie doesn't have any wheat in it, and it doesn't have any sweeteners in it. And it's just made from nuts and dates and apples and cinnamon. And I'm like, well, how could it look like a pie? It looks like a pie, though. Where's the gluten in that? You know? And so then I tried it, and it was delicious. And I was like, I need to know more about this, because at that point I had already spent more than 2 years not touching a dessert. And I was, I grew up as a really big, I was so into desserts. My mom would make these amazing, home-baked pies. And not being able to eat those for 2 years, going through all those holidays, was excruciating. But, going through the pain of stomach ulcers was more excruciating.
Right.
So that's when I became the raw food crusader. And at that point, it was also right around the time that I met my husband, Lithenian. So this is 2009, 2010. I moved to California, and the raw food movement is huge there. We went to all raw potlucks, sometimes three or four in a month. Mm-hmm. And I just started learning more and more about it, and I just started researching more and more. I met the owner of the Vegetarian Health Institute, and he hired me to do a lot of the coursework to actually put together exams for his program. His program didn't have exams yet, so it had a lot of, like, here's the information, but it didn't yet necessarily have very many homework assignments.
Right.
So I started creating the coursework for this thing that he had pulled together from all these different doctors and all these different amazing sources. So I got to basically get paid to learn. And I was like, this is great. Like, I want to keep working with this guy. So I worked with him for 5 years, and I learned so much. He ended up having me be the person who kind of represented the values of the company. Mm-hmm. So he would have me take other courses to find out whether or not they aligned with the values of the Vegetarian Health Institute, to find out where their coursework differed from ours or where it was in perfect alignment, so that we knew whether we could promote them in integrity or not.
Right.
So I was getting paid to learn even more. And then as the editor, as new content would come in, I would get to edit it, and I was getting paid to learn more. And so I started becoming more and more known as a sort of raw food guru, which became a very large part of my identity, which I've, I still kind of have it in me. It's there, but it's not, the dominant part of who I am anymore.
Right. And I guess the question for me is, when you find something that radically improves your life, it's understandable that you want everybody to have that same experience. How did you come to step away from that? How did you back down from that position? What helped you to understand a need to have a different approach?
Wow, you've actually framed it so well. You've actually given me part of the answer in your question, which is that something else helped me so much again. So in 2013, I was having a lot of trouble again with my health, and it was very strange to me because I had lived, about five years at that point, without getting sick. I was the kid who got sick five times a year or more and stayed sick for 2 weeks, and now I hadn't been sick in 5 years. And so all of a sudden I started developing health problems again. I'm like, why is this happening to me? And I had a lot of resentment that was happening in my marriage to Lathenian. And, you know, we were trying to work through it. We were so good at communicating and being very articulate and concise, and yet we were still hitting these brick walls. And I had this really powerful dream that I was on a road way ahead of him, and that he was on foot and that he couldn't catch up with me. And I decided that the only solution in this dream was that I had to go back in time. And so there was a steep cliff to the right of me, and I just jumped off that cliff, convinced I was going back in time. And I woke up, you know, as I was falling, I woke up and my whole life was changed. Like, there was a raw food potluck that night, and raw food was such a huge part of my identity back then. And I always went. But that night I didn't go because something was different. Mm-hmm. And I had another powerful dream that night where, again, I jumped off a balcony in this dream. And when I woke up, again, from falling, I was like, my whole life has to change, and it has to change right now. And this fire was lit within me, and yet I didn't even know what the fire was about. And I had briefly, you know, had just these few little interchanges with this woman on Kauai Island. And she said, you know, you could come and stay at my farm. She had mentioned that. And I thought, that's pie in the sky. There's no way I can afford plane tickets to Hawaii. I was living on very little money. And that morning I called her and I said, I want to go to Kauai Island. Like, let's do this. Let's make it happen. We only talked for an hour, and then I bought the plane tickets. Mm-hmm. And I emptied my bank account completely. I had $0. I had no idea how we were going to live, you know?
Right.
And we went to Kauai Island, and I met this amazing woman there. The timing was perfect because this woman was staying at the farm, and she was only going to be there for the next 30 days. And so we got to overlap with her for an entire month. And this woman became my mentor and my guru. She taught me, she didn't start teaching it to me originally. At first, she started facilitating a practice called consciousness awareness training on me. And
which involves what?
Well, it involves basically, now I understand it from a facilitator perspective. At the time, I just thought of it as, well, she's touching parts of my body. She's talking to me. She's leading me through breathing exercises, and I'm uncovering parts of my unconscious. Wow, this has never happened before. Mm-hmm. And so that was my perspective on it at the time. Now as a facilitator, I understand it as the facilitator basically allows the client to see themselves more clearly. You lead them deeper and deeper into themselves without ever actually taking the reins. You let them take the reins. You basically strengthen their own grip on themselves, and you let them take their own horses into themselves. And you do this, one, by you never get in the way of them feeling trust for themselves. You never, like, you never put any judgments on them, and you don't impose foreign ideas. You basically just reaffirm their ideas and lead them deeper into their own ideas. And this helps them get really down to the core of who they really are on a level that's previously been unconscious. And so this practice was so powerful for me that it turned me from a person who I thought I knew myself super, super well. And then I realized, I was like, wait, when they say that 80% of you or more is unconscious, they really mean it. Like, I actually stood at the entrance to myself, and I saw the gaping void of everything my consciousness didn't know about right. myself. And I realized that it was more powerful. What she was doing for me was helping create more permanent changes. Instead of dogmatically forcing myself into new lifestyle routines and disciplining my way through it, there was a way to actually go in and change the damage that was leading me towards unhealthy change choices in the first place.
Right, right. What you have described to me is intellectuals tend to be even more unaware of their unconscious than people who aren't intellectual, because they get it through their bodies or they get it through their emotions, depending upon where their strengths are, whether they're kinesthetic or emotional in terms of their learning. And people who are highly intellectual become somewhat fundamentalist. And to unlock that is to open up the body or open up the heart in ways that they are still in control, because they will feel they'll very easily feel out of control when an intellectual tries to become more relaxed and less dogmatic. Ithaca is a place full of intellectuals, and this is a huge issue here. And you've just described a way of unlocking stuckness, and that's very powerful. What have you done? Where has that taken you now? Where did that? What else happened in Kauai, and where have you come since then? Actually, we're going to save that question. Let's play another song because we're fastly racing through time on the show, and I want to get to at least three songs. So what should we play next?
Whatever the next one was.
The Purity Ring.
Yeah.
Obadir.
Sounds great.
Okie doke. Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Raiderly Phoenix. So Raiderly, can you pick up the story in Kauai and how you have changed since then?
So Kauai was a really powerful experience for me. I was there for 4.5 months, and something really, at the time it seemed devastating. 2 months in, the original people we were staying with on their farm, you know, they told us that basically we were going to need to start paying rent or leave because we couldn't actually stay at their farm. They had no facilities on it, and I required internet to continue my work for the Vegetarian Health Institute. And while I was kind of under the original impression the farm would feed us, that really turned out to not be the case. They primarily were just growing bananas and papayas, which was not a balanced diet. No matter what kind of raw foodist you are, that's not going to work out.
Go well from there.
Yeah, no. And they said, well, the going rate around here for rent is $900 a month. And I was like, whoa, we live on less than $900 a month. Like, there's no way that we could afford that. And so they'd give us a week to start paying rent or to move out. And I was just terrified. We were both terrified. You know, we had already scheduled our return flight for 4.5 months, and we, you know, we didn't know what else to do. We looked at trying to change our flight, and we realized it would cost, you know, well over $1,000 to do that. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know anyone else on the island. We were brand new to the island. So we started just going out, just trying to meet people, just trying to figure out something.
Sure.
And we went out to all these different farmers markets and things. And Laitanian was just this pillar of faith. Like, he just kept saying, something's going to happen Saturday. And Saturday was the sixth day. I'm like, I'm not waiting till Saturday just because you say something's going to happen Saturday.
You know, take the reins and run.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, we had gone to, like, for example, a farmers market on Wednesday. And it was weird. We hardly even talked to anyone because we both kind of felt that it wasn't the right time and it wasn't the right place. Saturday morning comes along, we're at the farmer's market there, because there's like a farmer's market every day of the week on Kauai Island at a different place. And we're at the Hanalei one, and it's just absolutely gorgeous out, and we're like dying of heat, and there's some water that this guy is selling at a stand. And then I find out he's not actually selling it. He tells me, if you're thirsty, drink. I'm like, okay. So I have a cup of water, and then we just start talking, and he starts talking about how he's got this rundown aquaponics system that's not working. And we're like, oh, aquaponics. Like, we're like so enthusiastic about that subject. Like, we looked into this garden pool. It's in Arizona, and they, like, you know, they grow so much of their own food. Their grocery bill is like less than $100 a month for a family of four because they get so much food out of their aquaponics system. So we were really excited. And he's like, well, you know, since you guys are so enthused about this and you guys are looking for a place to stay, you know, we have a place to stay. And, you know, if you guys could get our aquaponics system working, you could just stay there. So we go and they show us this place on the seventh day. Right. Yeah. And when I walked into this place, it was like walking into, you know, this magical paradise. There's these heart-shaped stones and these heart-shaped planters literally overflowing with flowers. There's these fruiting trees everywhere. They show us a shack with an outdoor kitchen and an outdoor shower. There's laundry facilities on site. There's wired-in internet. You know, and we have this little cabin made of plywood out in the middle of a stand of banana trees. And we're like, wow. And then coincidence beyond coincidence, they didn't have that shack booked until literally 2 days before our flight. So we only had 2 days to figure out where we were going to stay for right. The rest of our stay. It was just perfect. And so we spent the rest of our stay there on Kauai Island. And the thing about this experience of having that 1 week to find a place and then Laitanian's pillar of faith, it just changed me from a person who thought of the world as, you know, containing some coincidences and, you know, between the dream that led me there, how our relationship changed, how my health changed, and finding this magical place, I became a person who had faith in the universe. I became an optimistic person who believed that the universe was actually looking out for me and looking out for all of us.
Right, right. And it's... fear or anxiety does no good except make you blind to what's there. It can help you anticipate a crisis, but beyond the crisis, it's not a stance. It's not a healthy stance. And it's a process. So I'm going to take your words with a little bit of salt it's a practice to be of faith, trust and hope, which is the historic definition of faith, not any dogma or intellectual content, but all about the emotion of experience of trust and hope, which is in your body and your heart. How have you grown in that over those, what has it been, 4 or 5 years now?
Well, yeah, that was in 2013.
Yeah.
And since then, I started practicing more consciousness awareness training, and that got me really into my body. And as I started to see that there were no coincidences inside myself, it became more and more real to me that there were no coincidences in the outside world. I read a book called Frogs into Princes, which introduced me to neurolinguistic programming. And I learned that things like even people's eyeball movements, like right now I'm looking up and to the right, that indicates that I'm visualizing something in my mind. So I started realizing that, you know, even our eyeball movements aren't arbitrary. Every little gesture I'm making with my hands right now, it's not arbitrary. It's actually helping me think and helping me access data inside myself. And so realizing that there was nothing arbitrary in me meant that every single little event that ever happens isn't arbitrary. And so I really started to notice that, becoming aware of the synchronicities. I also read a book called The Celestine Prophecy, and it talked about, you know, the meanings of these synchronicities in our lives. And, it, you know, saying, you know, you think it's just arbitrary, you meet eyes with somebody at the grocery store, but it doesn't. If you meet eyes with somebody at the grocery store, you have a message for them and they have a message for you. And so I started taking it as a practice to start introducing myself more to people that I, you know, just happen to randomly feel drawn to. And time again, people will come into my life and it's just no accident. There is really no accidents.
Right. When you meet a person with openness, they will tend to respond with like openness, and there's a connection. There is nothing that's arbitrary or, in a certain sense, truly random, but there's nothing that's necessarily determined either.
Okay.
And so some people confuse your kind of language with it was meant to be, but it wasn't meant to be. You were open to it, so it happened. If you hadn't been open to it, or if you'd glanced at that person as opposed to the other person, something else would have happened. And that's trust. Yeah. Anyway, I'm rambling. I don't mean to step in on your story too much, but I'm hoping I'm extending it in a useful way.
Yeah. And there's lots of different little things that can happen, you know, when you meet a person and you have this faith that you're supposed to meet them for a reason. I mean, sometimes I feel drawn to tell people that I'm like an illustrator, for example, and that I do logos. And that's like how they know me. They know me as the person who does logos, because for some reason I just felt drawn to talk to them about that, or because that's what comes up. And sometimes what comes up is the person has a digestive issue and I relate to them because I've gone through severe digestive issues and rehabilitating my digestive system. And so they know me as the raw food person. Sometimes I meet people at like a board gaming gathering and they know me as the board game designer who creates games like, you know, the Heir to the Phoenix Crown or Voice of Conscience. And that's like how they know me. And then sometimes I meet people at like a consciousness retreat and they're going to know me as the consciousness alchemist. And so like all these different identities that I have, you know, they feel like they even have like a particular place where they fit in. They emerge at specific times for specific people. And you asked me at the beginning of the show, who am I? And it was just really cool to think I am a collective of beings, and seeing how all of them have their own little synchronistic places that they show up.
It also puts what you raised at the beginning, worried that you were introducing it too soon, the polyamory in perspective. Because having that kind of access to that many dimensions of yourself pulls you into intimacy in ways, whether or not it's physical.
Yes. Yeah. There's many different ways to be polyamorous too. So some people think of polyamory as being the same as an open relationship, and they're actually very different. So for me, I like to do polyamory the same way I would do monogamy, or the same way you'd think of monogamy, like completely enmeshing my life and my personality and what I am with someone else and who they are, meeting them on the bridge and becoming as connected to them as possible. So some people turn to polyamory because they kind of want everybody on the fringes and they want like a lot of different intimate relationships, but their idea of intimacy is only a small amount of overlap. So for me, it's about, you know, being able to have multiple really deep relationships. And, you know, there's also a time factor. Having two relationships already of that level of intimacy takes up a lot of my time. And I like that. I like my life, you know, having two different people that I bounce between. And there are two different perspectives, and how they access the different parts of me is really important to me.
The effect seems to be makes you more alive. More of you alive.
Yes. And that was a huge thing that changed my life when I met Greg, is I had already been with Laetitia for 6 going on 7 years. And there were parts of me that were just feeling super neglected. They were feeling like they were not seen, they were not felt, they were not heard. And those parts of me were angry and resentful. And, you know, they felt like they got kind of locked in the closet and forgotten. And Greg got to, you know, pull those parts of me out, the parts of me that Laetitian wasn't super okay with or wasn't super happy with or what didn't invite them to come out and play. Like, Greg invited those parts of me to just come out and play. And I feel like after, you know, being with him for well over a year now, that those parts of me have finally like found peace. Like, they're no longer resentful that they got locked away. They're like happy that they've found their place in the collective, so to speak.
Right. And not everything is timely. So things being locked away isn't necessarily a statement of condemnation. It's a statement of inaccessibility for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And because if they'd have been accessed by somebody other than Greg, there would have been a different
experience. Yeah. And one of the things that we, you know, teach as consciousness awareness facilitators is that, you know, there's a reason that things become unconscious. We do it to protect ourselves. We protect our consciousness as much as we can from things that are hidden back there. And so it's actually an act of self-love and self-preservation that we've hidden away parts of ourselves. Mm-hmm. The trick is knowing that, okay, now it's safe to bring them back out. Now it's okay.
And people who are unskillful bring things out that aren't timely or they sit on them too long.
Yes.
And learning how to be gentle or graceful in that awareness. I mean, and the big issue with polyamory is that people don't trust that you can have relationships of trust that are that complicated, that do not get hindered by jealousy or boundary issues.
So boundary issues is going to be different for each individual relationship. But for me, I prefer there to just not be boundaries in my relationships. Like, it's very clear to both of my husbands, like, you know, anything that you tell me, you know, should be open to my other husband as well. And we all live together, the three of us. We don't have secrets between the three of us. Like, they know pretty intimate information about each other. Even if they don't talk directly to each other about that stuff very often, like, it becomes part of me once it's communicated to me, and I don't want boundaries between me and either of them.
Otherwise, you're back in the box.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, How would you describe the wholeness of your life now and where the next steps are for you?
Good question. So my life right now, because it's spring, involves a lot of gardening. So when I'm not drawing, writing, board game designing, you know, or hanging out with either of my husbands, I'm out in the garden with a shovel or a mattock breaking up soil. I love to double dig my planters. Mm-hmm. I love to build, you know, stone planters and have like cascading herbs and permaculture everywhere. Building a permaculture paradise is a big part of my present and my future. Another part of my present and future is writing about my life. I love writing, and I love the process of revisiting my old journals and reflecting on things I've written in the past. And sometimes what I've written is just so captivating that I'll actually get sucked into my own writing. Mm-hmm. And I'll just be reading for an hour, and I'll just be like, wow, this part of my life was so important to me. And that's how that came to be. And that's when I learned that about myself, and seeing how it relates to today. And people have read pieces of my writing, and, you know, people who've read my book, Living Big and Traveling Far and $8,000 a Year, some of them tell me that their favorite part of the book was the part where I told a lot of my story with Lytenian, like how we met on OkCupid, how I moved to California to live with him, our experience on Kauai Island. And they say, you know, I love your storytelling ability. I want more. And so this has given rise to the idea that I want to write my life as a novel, as if you were reading a fictional novel, just mm-hmm. one bit of story after another, and just include like lots of dialogue, lots of action, lots of my thoughts and revelations. Because there really are multiple stories, and they're all interwoven together. Mm-hmm. And I think presenting it the way I experienced it is just going to be much more powerful than just writing an informational book. So currently right now, all the books I have for sale on my website, writerly.com, are all very informational, whereas what I'm writing now is very personal and experience-based, and I work on it every day, and it's a highlight of my day.
So letting the writing reflect the experience is where you are now.
Yes. Yeah, it's very, it's a poetic experience, and it's a journey. I very much enjoy it.
Neat. So
do you want me to do one of my poems, by the way?
Oh, sure. And then I have a question. Yeah, sure. Good.
So the name of this poem is Serious Condition, Madness. Marketing and manufacture of madness. There is a beneficiary to your sadness. Illness, illusion, prelude to solution, delusion. Would be wiser to wander under a whomping willow for wellness. Are you lonely in those office cubicles? Do you have healthy cuticles? Fortunes for the pharmaceuticals. Inventing disorders. You're on the border. Must be bipolar. You need a prescription for your serious condition. You may never recover from this lost lover. So take another. They're making money off your misery. If you look it up, you'll find it in history. The entire medical industry is making profane profit from prescriptions. It's nothing new to politicians. They're lining their pockets with our dismay, including the leaders of the FDA and the AMA, the corporations making billions off us ignorant civilians. Bayer, a chemical company catastrophe. DynCorp, a villainous vaccine conspiracy. DuPont, a putrid pathetic pathology. Dow and Monsanto, GMO, genetic modification, soil degeneration, seed depletion, agricultural destruction, ecological devastation, poisoning the world population. If you have cancer, there is an answer. If you are diabetic, you don't need a prosthetic. There is a cure, clean and pure. The sinister operations prefer for you to stay sick, dependent, insulin reverent. Doesn't matter if you have tuberculosis or halitosis. From the cure, they get no monetary gain, so they'll see your immune system slain and ignore the real causes to your pain. Living in the city, breathing in toxicity, conforming to society, stress and anxiety, positions of political piety, substance addiction, syrup proliferation, candy adaptations, artificial coloring, sugar smotherings, bread convolutions, profuse pollution, food dilution, liability absolution. There are so many connections. The law of attraction. Start with the subtraction of every negative distraction, every hasty reaction. Put your inspiration to action. Develop determination. Move with motivation. Manifest creation. If you're feeling suspicion or about to have a conniption because of my spoken description of this situation, that's a sign of a serious condition for which I think you need a prescription.
I want to just sit with that for a second, and my question was going to be, how do you take the people would dismiss what you're doing if they were to call it self-absorbed, but being self-aware and being self-absorbed is only different in terms of the audience for your life. You know, if the audience for your life is yourself, you're self-absorbed. But if the audience for your life is how it opens up things that others can think about as a gift, not as a contract, which all of these monetized things have to do with our contractual relationships. And if we fail in our contracts, we then can coerce each other to comply. Whereas if we have a gift, we can't coerce because the gift is taken or not taken, and community is built on that kind of voluntary, freely given and freely taken piece, which is at odds and in constant tension with what we can make into contracts. It's the difference between a covenant and a contract. A marriage vow is a covenant vow. A contract is an agreement about services.
Wow, there's two things there I want to respond to, which is, you know, for me, there's a kind of linguistic fun we can have here with words.
Sure.
There's being self-centered, mm-hmm. and there's being centered within yourself.
Absolutely.
And there's this very significant difference there. And I think that everyone could benefit from being more centered within themselves.
And the paradox is that from afar, they look almost the same. and paradoxically, we have to experience each state in order to know where we need to be at a moment.
Yes. The other thing I wanted to respond to is what a, you know, marriage contract can look like. And I've come to figure, you know, a lot of people ask me, what does it mean for me to have two husbands? And for me, it's a commitment to keep falling back in love, because you can't expect to really stay in love 24/7 every moment of the day for the rest of your life. And so what it means to me to be married is that if we fall out of love, which we will, mm-hmm. we're going to both make an active, proactive effort to speak each other's love languages and to fall back in love again.
Mm-hmm. And what's often translated as the word hesed in Hebrew is what's translated as covenant love or covenant loyalty. Mm-hmm. And that is to do for the other what they cannot do for themselves but need in order to thrive, and to ask of another what you can't do for yourself but you need in order to thrive. Mm-hmm. And in that way, the falling into love is always going to happen, because you're not redundant. You're constantly discovering and exploring a new space.
That's beautiful.
We're coming towards the end of the show, and what I like to do at the end is to reflect, have the guest reflect upon what do you do on a throughout the day, daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, to balance your life, to bring emotional, intellectual, physical integration or balance, which the three of them to me are spiritual because they're kind of three different orthogonal, you know, they're three different axes. They're completely different things, but they come together and they form a profound spiritual experience. What do you do to take care of yourself, and how do you know you need to do it?
Well, I know I need to do it just by remembering. I remember my entire life that used to be really dark and really not balanced. And I've kind of designed my entire life full of practices now to keep recentering and rebalancing continually. So consciousness awareness training is a big part of that, which calls under, I put it under a blanket term, consciousness alchemy, for all the different practices. So for example, yoga is a form of consciousness alchemy, which I do, you know, probably on a weekly or a monthly basis. And exercises like sending my awareness down to my feet, mm-hmm. and just running that signal of my brain all the way down into my toes and swinging into my fingertips. Yes.
It involves the full arc of that.
Absolutely.
Body.
And gardening's a huge practice for me. It's very much connecting with the nature and with the earth. I do little consciousness exercises throughout my day where I notice everything I can hear. And I just keep asking myself, what else can I hear? What else? Until I've noticed, you know, my own heartbeat, until I've noticed the birds and the whir of a fan that was just background noise and the fridge making its little blurb, blurb, blurb. Mm-hmm. And then I ask myself, what can I see? What else can I see? What else? Mm-hmm. And then I ask, well, what can I taste in my mouth? Well, if I move my tongue around, does it taste any different? I take a deep inhale and what can I smell? And if I walk 2 feet over here, what else can I smell? And, you know, I do that with my whole body. Can I feel my shirt? Can I feel my pants? Can I feel my shoes? Can I feel the floor? You know, can I feel the sense of gravity pulling me into my seat right now? And all of these little practices help me bring me more centered into myself, more centered into the moment, give me a sense of perspective and balance. And I try to take those with me everywhere I go. I try to make it a pervasive aspect of who I am.
So what you've described is the life of the mystic. Who's focused on the more, you know, in whatever dimension or whatever situation. There are two things that I'd like to follow up with. And one is, part of life inevitably, though, is being reactive. And how do you cultivate your ability to react as opposed to proact? All of those disciplines you described were proactive. What are your reactive practices?
Deep breaths.
Uh-huh.
I think we all kind of, you know, even as I was just noticing yesterday that I was doing Ujjayi breathing, which is a yogic breathing technique where you make like a sort of a hissing noise in your throat. You go, I don't know if you guys can hear that over the radio, but you make a hissing noise in your throat as you inhale and exhale. And that I used to do to control my anger as a child, like long before I'd ever taken a yogic practice.
Sure.
But I had a lot of pent up anger, you know, towards people who weren't looking out for me or who were being unfair. And I used that to kind of calm myself down before I responded. But I think, you know, sometimes situations call for a lot more than breathing. Sometimes what I do is I say, look, you know, I care about this, you know, conflict that we're having, but before I can address it more, I need to go take a breather by myself, maybe do some writing. We can come back to this in a couple hours. Is that okay? You know, and that's like a personal conflict. Sometimes you need to be more decisive than that. And when I have to be decisive, I take a moment to perceive the map inside myself of my own convictions. So it's like a moment of looking inward, and it's kind of like I make kind of a visual, but this visual is a very abstract artwork where I'm just sort of drawing connections between all of my convictions. And I take that moment to kind of steel myself to be completely convinced of one thing, because you need to be, so if you're in a moment where you need to be decisive, you can't have a hesitation. You can't have that other part of the collective that actually feels something else speaking up.
You can't be living the paradox.
Right. At that moment, it's a time to just be a united force.
Yeah, so. Yeah. And another piece of this puzzle is, you can be a mystic with faith, with this hope and trust, but you're also a materialist. You're a material being, and you have to make a living. How have you come to balance those pursuits, which are proactive and intentional, and they are coming with mammon or lucre or whatever pejorative you want to do, or just money. I mean, money is a symbol of our labor, and the value that we give things by our attitudes towards them. How have you made peace with that so that you can make a living?
Well, I do artwork freelance. I have several board games for sale. The Voice of Conscience is like my bestseller because it helps people really delve into themselves and their personal relationships through ethical quandaries on each card. And, you know, in addition to doing like logo vector art, they kind of overlap because I can do artwork for my board games or I can do artwork for other people and get paid for that. I also have my books for sale on my website. Raiderly is spelled R-A-E-D-E-R-L-E, and Raiderly.com. You know, it's got all of my books, and Living Big and Traveling Far and $8,000 a year has helped a lot of people. People are pretty excited when they realize like how much more they could be doing to maximize their lifestyle and doing what they really want to do on the money they're already earning.
Right. They don't have to do anything different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And hopefully in the future, you know, I'll be making more of my income from these novels I'm writing right now, which I'm kind of looking forward to the day when I can say that I've sold hundreds of thousands of copies, because mm-hmm. I really believe that what I'm writing is going to be worth that.
Right. And whether or not it sells that, it's worth that to you and those who love you.
Exactly. And just the process itself is so healing to me that mm-hmm. it's worth doing even if I never made a penny.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, yeah, that is the difference. It's a quality of non-attachment while engaged.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Raiderly, it has been wonderful to get to know you. What shall we close this session this time with? What song shall we close it with?
Let's do the Arena.
Okay. And do you want to say anything about it before we play it?
Lindsay Stirling is following her heart, and I really admire that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this has been the Made of Clay Report. And you can find about 350 hours, 330 guests of past Made of Clay reports at madeofclay.org.